Good morning, everyone. Our first case today is State v. Lewis Williams. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Valeria Dominguez on behalf of the state.
Michelle Friedman, Assistant Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Lewis Williams.
Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Good morning, Your Honor. Nicholas C. Harbist, Blank Rome, on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey. Amicus.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Dominguez, please go ahead.
Thank you. May I reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal?
We'll have you back, perhaps for a little less.
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This court has already recognized that a tenant generally does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the common areas of a multi-unit residence. The appellate division's ruling in this case erroneously carves out an exception for tenants of boarding and rooming houses. In finding a reasonable expectation of privacy in the common areas of an unlocked multi-unit boarding house, even if the tenants' rooms were equipped with padlocks, the appellate division gave tenants of boarding and rooming houses greater privacy rights than those afforded to residents of other multi-unit dwellings. In assessing whether there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in the common areas of a multi-unit building, there is no meaningful distinction between boarding houses and rooming houses and other types of multi-unit dwellings. Because residences of boarding houses, like residences of other multi-unit dwellings, have no control or dominion over common areas, which are open and accessible to other occupants and their guests, there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in such areas. The opinion also establishes an unworkable rule, as it will block police from entering the common areas of buildings when simply conducting investigations. This is exemplified here, where police were investigating a shooting in real time. The police responded to 86 Spring Street upon learning that the suspect either ran to or resided at that location. From the outside, 86 Spring Street appeared to be an attached row house. But when the officer knocked on the door, which was unlocked and unsecured, the door opened, revealing a hallway lined with interior doors equipped with padlocks. To the officer, based on his experience working in Trenton, this appeared to be a multi-unit boarding house. The officers had a right to enter the common hallway, as any other visitor would have had to, in order to speak with the individual tenants to investigate the report that the shooting suspect resided at 86 Spring Street. Because a defendant does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the common areas of a multi-unit residence, and there's no meaningful distinction between boarding houses and other types of multi-unit dwellings, we respectfully ask this court to reverse the judgment of the appellate division. We also ask this court to deny defendant's motion to expand the record because the photographs obtained from Google Maps were not a part of the record either in the trial court or in the appellate division. They have not been authenticated, and the outside appearance of 86 Spring Street is irrelevant to whether the tenants have a reasonable expectation of privacy to the common areas of the boarding house. Thank you.
To make us take a situation where people live in a communal dwelling with locks on their rooms, and they share a common hallway, kitchen, and bathroom, isn't that more similar to a single dwelling home with multiple housemates than it is to a building, an apartment building, with fully sustained separate units?
Two responses, Your Honor. The first is when we are looking at a private residence, that area is already protected. It's protected under the Fourth Amendment, as opposed to looking at common areas of multi-unit dwellings, where there has been a recognition generally that there's no reasonable expectation there. And there's a difference between a private residence where the individuals who live there are functioning as a family, whether they're blood related or not, or as roommates, where there is some control over the common areas. There is a dialogue that can be had regarding, you know, the spaces in the house, as opposed to a situation where the residents are renting a particular space, whether it be a room in a boarding house, an apartment, or even the second floor of a two-family house. That's different because they don't have control over the common areas. They can't prevent access to the other tenants. They can't prevent access to the other tenants' visitors. They don't have control. It's accessible to other people, particularly when we're looking at a hallway, which is certainly accessible to any other occupant, any other visitor, to access in order to get to the different rooms.
So in the example that we're talking about, does a person have a reasonable expectation of privacy as they walk from their small bedroom unit, 8x8, through a hallway to the bathroom?
It's our position that they do not, because that hallway is accessible to other occupants. It's accessible to their visitors, to maintenance workers, the landlord, and anything that they do there, any action, anything that they leave in the common areas is visible to other people who have access to their rooms.
And I take it that the fact that the building itself, the front of the building, is closed to the public, there's a door that is not open, whether it's locked or unlocked, doesn't affect your analysis of whether a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy simply walking to the bathroom?
No, Your Honor, and that's, again, because this is an area that is accessible to other people. So anything that you do there, you can't expect that nobody else will see that. You don't know who else is walking in the, you know, boarding house at any particular time. You don't know what other visitors are there, and they can surely see anything that happens in the common areas versus your particular room. In the case of a boarding house, where you absolutely have control over who has access to your room, who has visibility to the interior.
Counsel?
Yes.
You said that there's no meaningful distinction between an apartment house and a rooming house or boarding house. But the legislature has made critical distinctions, have they not? Are you familiar with the Rooming and Boarding House Act of 1979?
Yes, Your Honor.
And are you aware of the Bill of Rights that have been given to residents of rooming houses and boarding houses?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I take it you're also aware of of the regulations that have been passed to protect.
Yes.
So starting with the regulations, and this would seem to indicate, at least that the legislature expected that residents of rooming houses would be protected from people on the outside. NJAC 5:27-6.1 requires that the outside door have a heavy duty deadlock, correct? It requires also that there be exterior doorbells audible throughout the building when in use. Correct? That's I.
Yes.
The Bill of Rights says that the residents will be have all of the constitutional protections of everyone else. You're familiar with this legislative enactment that applies to boarding houses and rooming houses, not apartment houses. Doesn't this legislative scheme indicate that the residents of boarding houses and rooming houses, in the mind of the legislature, have a reasonable expectation of privacy from people just wandering in from the outside into the common areas of a rooming house or a boarding house?
A few responses, Your Honor. I would note initially that the requirement of the lock on the exterior of the door and the doorbell, that's under specifically the subchapter entitled security. So the purpose of a lock is to secure the residence. It's not in a way to create a privacy expectation. I would also note
when you lock the door to your house, whether it's a room, whether it's a single family house or a rooming house, is that not an expectation that someone just cannot walk through the door, whether it's a police officer or anyone walking down the street?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it may be an indicator of privacy of your expectations, but it's not dispositive of the issue, just as if a private residence door is left routinely unlocked and even wide open, that doesn't change the fact that that is still protected property.
Of course, I agree with you. If you left your door unlocked your home, you wouldn't expect that people have a right to open it and enter, do you?
Right, absolutely.
Not even a police officer, correct?
Absolutely. But the presence of a lock doesn't mean that you have an expectation of privacy in an area when there's other occupants accessing that same area, there's other visitors, the landlord, maintenance worker. I mean, there's a number of people who can access the hallways.
Of course, the people who live there, but not the outside. If there are six people living in a rooming house, it doesn't mean that the world has a right of entry. No?
I would also draw the court's attention to NJAC 5:27-34, which deals with access to agency representatives. And it specifically says that licensees shall not in any manner obstruct and shall affirmatively facilitate access for employees of public agencies and private social services and health agencies seeking to visit any residence or to have contact with any residence generally. So in addition to the lock, which is absolutely a regulation of the exterior door, the tenants of the boarding houses have have the ability to allow visitors in. There is a reasonable access to the tenants.
And when you look at apartment buildings, many of them have locks that all the tenants have a key or a card. Yeah. That can access to. So when your point is that there are not that many distinctions between apartment buildings and the rooming houses, and one of those similarities in many cases is there's an outside lock, and yet our law would suggest that an outside lock does not mean that there is a reasonable expectation of privacy to the front. The common areas after you get through that lock. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. That's exactly our position. And I would also note here that we're talking about a shooting investigation that's unfolding in real time. And so the officers were investigating a report of that the suspect either resided or ran to 86 Spring Street. Of course, they have an obligation to investigate that report.
You haven't argued exigent circumstances. You've presented this to us on one issue, and tell me if I'm mistaken about this, whether or not the residents of a boarding house, rooming house, have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and you have purposely decided not to present to us whether or not the officers had exigent circumstances to enter. Am I not correct?
No, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor, and I don't... I'm not bringing up the fact that this was a shooting investigation in any way to rely on the exigency exception. We have not.
And you're not arguing that these officers didn't have sufficient time to get a warrant. You're not arguing that. You've never presented that argument.
Right, but I'm just noting that in attempting to corroborate this report that the suspect lived at 86 Spring Street, the most efficient way to follow up on that report would be to knock on the front door. And then at that point, once the door, because it was unsecured and unlocked, opened, revealing a hallway of lined rooms with padlocks, the officer, based on his experience, knew that this was a boarding house. And so clearly, in order to speak with the individual tenants, he would have to access, like anyone else would have, the hallways in order to knock on the doors.
Haven't we already seen some cases where people are living with family members and they padlock their particular bedroom door, and yet we've never said that police officers can simply walk into those individual units because multiple people are living in that space and there is shared space and there's separated, secure, more private space, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And when we are talking about a private residence, certainly an officer couldn't enter into the common areas. But when we're looking at this particular officer with over 10 years experience working in Trenton, having been inside different boarding houses in Trenton, being familiar with what the exterior of a boarding house in Trenton looks like and the interior, when he knocked on the front door, it was apparent to him that this was a boarding house. This was a multi-unit dwelling, which is not the scheme.
But you're equating, and you can tell from the questioning, a number of us are asking similar questions. You're equating all of these multiple dwelling units as if they are the same. And yet there are many similarities to the situation presented by the facts of this premises to a single family dwelling. From the outside, an officer could have perceived that to be nothing more than a single family residence. And if they knocked on a single family residence and the door happened to open, the officer would never think that they could simply just walk in, correct? So somehow, because people of lesser means are sharing the residence with partially more secure places and some more shared spaces, somehow their rights to privacy are different and less. That's essentially the position that the state is taking, is it not?
No, Your Honor. We're not asking this court to treat tenants of boarding houses differently than tenants of any other multi-unit dwellings. We're just simply saying that there's a distinction between boarding houses and other types of multi-unit dwellings and private residences. When an officer knocks on a private residence door, even if it's unlocked, it reveals a living space. In this case, we have the officer looking from the exterior, thinking this is a two-story attached row house. This could be a boarding house. He knocks on the door. It's padlocked. Because he's worked in Trenton for over 10 years. He's been in other boarding houses. This is a boarding house.
But
this is not.
He could just as easily have been walking into their kitchen or their living room. These boarding houses are basically single family houses that have been converted. All of the people who live in those individual rooms, 8x8, they're just bedrooms. They're commonly sharing the living room, the kitchen, and other common areas. So when they come in, there could be people in their night clothes or whatever. Am I not mistaken? As they're just like entering as though they have the rule of the roost.
Yes, Your Honor, but the fact is in the common hallways in particular, you're going to have other occupants accessing those hallways. You're going to have their visitors. There's going to be other people. So you might expect privacy, but it's not reasonable to expect that when you know that there are other people that have access to that area and you can't block access to those hallways. You're not in possession. And that's
the
exactly
same. The same could be true of any interior apartment space shared by multiple people. And the officers can't just walk into the apartment because more than one person, unrelated by blood, happened to live there. Now, of course, if one consents to entry, you have the entry by consent, you might have exigent circumstances, but there is a difference in whether or not the law permits the officer to simply walk through the door because the door opens when knocked on.
Certainly, Your Honor, the officer can't walk into the apartment, and we've never suggested that an officer can walk into the rooms. It's just that it's our position that they can absolutely access, just like any other visitor could, the hallways, the common area.
But it's not any, I'm sorry, Mr. Mingit, but it's not really any other visitor. I think Justice Alvin also mentioned, this is not open to the world. There are a certain number of people that live there. Certainly, they might have visitors that come, but it's not the case that this is a public building that there are going to be tons of people walking through at any given moment. I don't think, you know, somebody living in one of these rooming houses expects that when they leave to go take a shower and access this hallway, that they're going to be met with people from the general public just walking around this space. I mean, I just think that there's certainly a distinct the fact that these rooms are just rooms. They're not apartments where there is a contained unit that has a kitchen and a bathroom. These people have to leave their small room in order to access spaces that they need in order to function and live in this place. So, I mean, the idea that anyone could be in the hallway at any time, I'm not sure where that argument goes, because this is not a place that's open to just any and any everyone from the general public. There's a door. There's an outside door. Whether it's locked or unlocked, there's a door. This is not a place that's publicly accessible to everyone. I mean, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I mean, there, it might not be free-flowing traffic, but there's always a possibility that other people that you don't know, maybe that you don't even want, might still be in the hallways, because you're renting the room in a boarding house, you're renting an apartment in the apartment building situation, you're not in possession of the hallways, you can't control who accesses the hallway. He couldn't control if another tenant had allowed the, you know, heard the officer's knock and allowed the officer to come in. It might not be excessive traffic, but certainly there might be some, and that can't be when you're renting a room in, or an apartment or any type of, if you're living in a multi-unit dwelling, it's certainly not unexpected that you might have other people accessing
those. This is different from the consent that a roommate might offer if a police officer knocks. The logical extension of your argument, if I understand it correctly, is if you have no reasonable expectation of privacy, an officer can simply come up, open the door, and walk in at any time.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, we have the unsecured front door. We have the interior doors that were locked. And the officer, to him, based on his experience, again, this was a boarding house. And in order
Do we know whether that front door was always kept open? Do we know whether, and does that matter? That's my first question.
It's our position that it doesn't matter, that even if this door was always locked, if this is a boarding house, if we're talking about a multi-unit dwelling, there is no expectation of privacy, reasonable expectation of privacy in those common areas. In regarding to what the record, what we know in the record, we don't know. We know that on the two separate occasions that the officer entered this particular boarding house, the door was unlocked and it was unsecured in any way. But we don't know if it was routinely kept unlocked or locked.
So counsel, I had referred to the regulations, but and one of them was I'm just going to read it to you. In terms of, like, what did the legislature have in mind in terms of the reasonable expectation of privacy of the residents of a rooming house? And it's, the main entrance door shall be equipped with an exterior doorbell audible throughout the building when in use. Like, what is the common purpose of a doorbell? I mean, the doorbell is the signal to people to come to the front door and decide whether or not to permit entry. And this is throughout the building to anyone. Doesn't that, and the requirement that there be a lock and that the door be closed, this is all the regulations in the statute, suggest that the legislature was concerned about the privacy. They actually say that in the statute, privacy and you're not having any lesser constitutional rights than anyone else. Doesn't that suggest a legislative policy, forget about constitutional, to protect the privacy interests of the residents of a rooming house?
And sure, we've never suggested that they don't have an expectation of privacy to their rooms, to their individual rooms, which is what they're renting, but just that they don't have it in the common hallways. And even though there might be a doorbell to alert, the tenants of any presence outside, that doesn't take away from the fact that we're still talking about common areas that are accessible and visible to other people, that other people, entry, would... Yes, Your Honor.
So isn't that, as Justice LaVecchia mentioned, treating people with lesser means differently? Because these are people who can only afford to live in a place where they can't afford an apartment, where they would have a self-contained unit that has their own bathroom and their own kitchen and living area. They're living in a place where they can only afford an this small room where they have to share a bathroom and share a kitchen and living areas with other individuals. That's different from an apartment building. Would you agree? That's different from an apartment building?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
So isn't that treating these people with lesser means differently? In order for somebody in a rooming house to use the bathroom, they're potentially exposing themselves to officers walking around and peeking into their rooms because, based on your argument, an officer can just walk in and out of a rooming house as they please at any given time.
A few responses, Your Honor. We're not asking this court to treat tenants, again, of boarding houses differently than any other resident of any other multi-unit dwelling. And I would also note that in this case, we have the officers merely accessing the hallway to knock on the individual doors. They were not peeking into rooms. The two female tenants, the interactions were limited to just two questions. Do you live with any men, and have you heard anything? And there's no obligation for them to answer the door, of course. So they weren't peeking in, they weren't engaging in any detailed search of any type. They were simply accessing the hallways to knock on the doors to alert the tenants to speak with them.
They could have rang the doorbell. They could have rang the doorbell. And to follow up on Justice Pierre-Louis' question, the statutes that I have referred to have been specifically referred to protect the rights of the poor, the elderly, and disabled, because that is the community that typically benefit from rooming and boarding houses. And the legislature wanted to make certain that that constituency of people who were typically going to wind up in these houses were going to have their constitutional and privacy rights protected. Am I not mistaken?
Yes, Your Honor. But I would also argue that given the population of boarding houses, they would also want the police to have access to investigate whether or not a tenant may be armed, may have been involved in a shooting. Surely they would want to allow
officers. They can call them. When you have exigent circumstances, you can enter. But you've laid your argument out on whether or not a reasonable expectation of privacy at the front door. That's right.
Yes, Your Honor. As to the doorbell, there's nothing in this record suggesting that there was a doorbell. I understand that it's required in the regulations, but the officer knocked on the door, which, you know, seems to indicate that there wasn't a doorbell. Had there been one, surely he would have rung it. He did knock on the front door, and at that point, it was apparent to him that it was a boarding house, and in order to actually be able to speak with the tenants, knocking on the front door is not going to alert anyone of their presence when we're talking about.
Aren't we speculating as you make that argument? We don't have a record on that point.
Right. We don't have Your Honor, we don't have a record regarding the doorbell.
If anything, we should presume that there is one, since the law requires one.
Yes.
Anything.
Right, yes, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record regarding that.
To be clear, there's not an allegation that the police acted in bad faith in this case. Am I correct?
Right, yes, Your Honor.
It's just a straightforward legal question as to what protections apply to this dwelling.
Yes. And again, it's our position that there's no significant distinction between boarding houses and any other type of multi-unit dwellings, and this court has already recognized that there is a diminished expectation of privacy or none at all in common hallways of other multi-unit dwellings. And so we would ask this court that there's no reason to distinguish common hallways of boarding houses from any other type of multi-unit dwellings.
Thank you, Ms. Dominguez. Ms. Friedman.
Good morning, and may it please the court. As Justice Albin explained in Brown, the constitutional protections afforded to the home make no distinction between a manor estate in an affluent town and a ramshackle hovel in an impoverished city. The occupants of both structures are clothed with the same constitutional rights. Yet here, the state petitioner seeks to strip a group of citizens of the very same constitutional protections that the court spoke of in Brown, specifically the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Paragraph 7, merely by virtue of the fact that they live in boarding and rooming houses. The appellate division already correctly ruled in this case that when an officer conducts a warrantless intrusion through the front door of a boarding or rooming house, those constitutional privacy protections apply with equal force. That is, those constitutional rights within the home don't somehow disappear by virtue of one's status as a resident in a boarding or rooming house. This court should affirm the appellate division's cogent and well-reasoned decision for four fundamental reasons. First, the shared living spaces within a boarding and rooming house are part of the home itself, and therefore are subject to our sacrosanct constitutional privacy protections that have always applied to the home. Second, and interrelatedly, because a boarding or rooming house is not open to the public, tenants of these types of homes enjoy a reasonable expectation of privacy within their homes. Third, the mere fact that here the front door's lock was either unlocked or malfunctioning on the particular date in question is not dispositive and does not serve to vitiate the tenant's constitutional privacy rights. And fourth, this court should affirm the appellate division's decision because a ruling to the contrary would disproportionately impact our most impoverished, elderly, and disabled citizens. For each of these reasons, this court should affirm the appellate division's decision. That concludes my opening remarks. Now, turning to my first point.
I have a question for you, Ms. Friedman. Give us a principal distinction, if you would, between apartments, as to which this court has already ruled that the common area is there is no reasonable expectation of privacy on the part of the residents, and the boarding houses. So if you were asked to differentiate those two, and whatever your views may be about apartments, we assume that's the law in New Jersey.
Okay.
How would you differentiate?
So apartment buildings contain multiple self-contained homes in that each apartment is its own self-contained home. An apartment itself contains a bathroom with its own running water. There's a shower within an apartment. There's a stove and an oven, usually a kitchen within its own right. There's a bedroom. So an individual in their own apartment doesn't need to leave the apartment itself in order to access the basic living functions.
Many apartments have common laundry areas. So you have the basement, obviously. That's a function that people have to have. In many apartments, it's not in the individual unit. You go to that common area downstairs. And that's why I'm talking about a principal distinction. Why doesn't the laundry area put the apartment in the same category as the rooming or boarding house, which I agree with you, have many more common functions than the apartment?
So I think that the laundry room is an excellent point. I think that the laundry room in an apartment building is a little bit of a gray area. And I think that some apartment buildings don't necessarily fit into a black or white category. I think that we do have some gray areas, which I think is why some of our apartment and multi-building cases, I think that the law is a little bit unclear. I think that the black letter law about multi-unit buildings isn't as clear as we might think on its face, which is why maybe we should have a totality of the circumstances test for some apartment buildings, like ones that have laundry rooms.
You're making that argument for potentially another case, but you're
for another
essentially
day.
You're essentially agreeing that there are strong areas of similarity between the type of homes that we're talking about today and apartments.
No, Your Honor. I am merely suggesting that there could be a case for another day that maybe in some circumstances that are not presented here, that some apartment buildings that on facts that are not presented might share similarities to other homes not presented here. And I only say that to suggest that not all apartment buildings fit in a simple box. There are large apartment buildings. You know, there's so many different types. And I think that our case law isn't as clear as one might think on its face, because even Jefferson and Sancion stand for the proposition that individuals who live in an apartment buildings do, in fact, have a reasonable expectation of privacy within multi-unit and apartment buildings in common areas. So while I do acknowledge that our case law generally supports the proposition that individuals in apartment buildings do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in apartment buildings in their common areas, I do think that our case law is not as clear as it could be, and that this court has not squarely addressed the issue.
Can the same be said of rooming and boarding homes? You mentioned the totality of the circumstances test. Wouldn't it matter if in a particular case, because of the way it's constructed, laid out, or used, that a rooming house or boarding house might have a different configuration and or expectation than another one? For example, if in fact there were facilities that were, let's just say, I asked the question before, you talked about the front door, whether it's locked, unlocked, doorbell, no doorbell. Was it common for delivery men and others to commonly enter without knocking or ringing the bell to deliver, to remove, to visit, to maybe even observe, look at a room with the idea of possibly renting it? And what I'm trying to just flesh out is, just as you're suggesting that in the case of apartment complexes, a lot of them are different and they may have different considerations, can the same be said of boarding houses and rooming houses? And should there be a totality of the circumstances test requiring an individualized assessment of the facility, of the location, of the home?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And here's why. I think that at the end of the day, boarding houses and rooming houses are really simple to understand. I know that the statutes are kind of convoluted, but that at the end of the day, what we're really talking about is a self-contained home where each individual is assigned to sleep in a separate bedroom, but they're sharing the remaining rooms in the house with each other. For a boarding house, they also are entitled to personal or financial services.
This was raised in some of the briefs too. And there may be some case law on it as well, that, for example, in a fraternity or a sorority where you first, I don't know if you ever lived in one, not suggesting I may have in the past, you enter a fraternity or a sorority, and the open area at the entranceway, which is always open so that professors come in and out, students come in and out, delivery people come in and out, there's a living room and a kitchen and a dining area, and then you go up to the hallway.
Professors were coming in and out of your fraternity house, Justice Sullivan?
I didn't suggest that this pertains in any way to me or my personal history. I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just suggesting that could be a structure. Would that have the same protection or lack of protection as the rooming house you're talking about, because they're essentially constructed in the same fashion?
Well, that was going to be my next point, but I'm not going to say that.
I read your mind.
I'm not going to say that professors should be coming in and out. So what I was going to say is that that this is not a new paradigm. That even though some of us on this virtual call may not have personal experience with boarding and rooming houses, that really this is the same old paradigm reinvented. That this is the same type of situation as friends who might be renting out a house. Oftentimes we see this with millennials in like the Hoboken, Jersey City area. You know, they're sleeping in separate bedrooms, but they're otherwise sharing the kitchen, the dining room, the bathroom. This is the same paradigm as friends who might be renting a beach home or a lake house. They're sleeping in separate bedrooms, but they're otherwise sharing the common area, so the bathroom.
How about a fraternity or a sorority?
I would say it's the same as a fraternity or a sorority house as well, because they're sleeping in separate bedrooms, but they're otherwise sharing the shared living spaces. And so this, there's nothing new or unique about this. And so contrary to the state's assertion, the mere fact that individuals are sharing some of the rooms at the house does not automatically make an individual forfeit their constitutional privacy rights, because it's not about the sharing of the rooms, but rather it's about whether or not the property is open to the public. Now, your example about the professors coming in and out, that sounds more about whether it hinges on whether it was open to the public, which sounds like a separate issue. And I think that brings me to my second point. I'm not sure if I answered Your Honor's question fully.
That's really what I wanted to get at. Is it a case-by-case analysis? Does it depend on whether the property, is in fact open to the public, because it's not the same as a single family dwelling? Is that how we should analyze this and look at this?
I don't believe that it should be a case-by-case analysis, because the state is arguing for a categorical rule that all boarding and rooming houses should be considered open to the public by virtue of the fact that they're boarding and rooming.
Let's assume they're wrong for a minute.
Okay.
Should it be a case-by-case analysis? I'm not taking one side or the other. I'm just saying,
as
part of your argument, should it not be a case-by-case analysis so that you can consider what, in fact, is the expectation of privacy in this place that is not a single-family dwelling? It's clearly not somebody's home. In fact, the landlord clearly may not even live there, and the legislature had to pass laws to tell landlords of these places to provide some modicum of security for their residents. So right. What should be the standard, and how should we apply it?
So I think that the standard should be that boarding and rooming houses are not open to the public. I guess in some, there can be some exceptions to that in really, really outrageous, outlandish cases. So, for example, in City of Evanston v. Hopkins, this was an Illinois case from 1947, there was a home that was, it actually turned out to be a brothel, but they were calling it, they were holding it out to be a rooming house. And there was a sign outside the door that said public telephone. And in those circumstances, you know, way before cell phones, in those circumstances, the court said, okay, you can't just call something a rooming house and have a sign outside that says public telephone. Under those circumstances, it's open to the public. But generally speaking, you can't just say, oh, something's a rooming house, so therefore it's open to the public. There needs to be some sort of sign or invitation to the public. You know, boarding and rooming houses, people live here. They sign leasing agreements. There's an exchange of money. They have reasonable expectations of privacy, especially because, as Justice Albin was indicating, there's the Boarding and Rooming House Act of 1979. There's all of these different statutory explanations for why individuals do have these privacy rights, and we've tried to codify these statutory rights so that we don't carve out.
Ms. Friedman,
yes, Your Honor.
The police also need direction in terms of what they need to do, and so yes. I mean, the more amorphous and fuzzy the line, the more difficult it will be for them to decide whether or not to get a warrant or not get a warrant. And the benefit of having clear lines of distinction is that there'll be just fewer motions to suppress, which will benefit law enforcement. So it seems to me that the legislature has defined rooming and boarding houses, and as you're suggesting, the general rule should perhaps be that you get a warrant if there's not an exception to the warrant requirement, unless in an individual case, the door is always open, everyone in the town is going through the boarding house, that might be a different story. What do you have to say about that?
Yes, Your Honor.
But Ms. Friedman, you were just...
Let her finish,
I'm sorry, please continue.
Go ahead.
Our constitutional mandate is for officers to get a warrant. That's what the Constitution requires, and they can't just be barging into people's homes because this is a boarding house. They also could have investigated this outside of the home. They could have waited right outside the door and waited for individuals who lived there to enter and exit and say, hi, have you heard any shots? Do you know anyone who lives in the area who has the name Lewis? They could have waited for someone to enter or exit and say, hi, will you give me consent to search? They could have given them the consent to search form. So there are other ways to get into a home without just asserting that the home has no constitutional protection.
Can one resident of a boarding house in which there are 25 residents consent to the search of common areas on behalf of all those residents?
I believe that it would work the same way as any other third-party consent in a single-family home case.
Is that mean yes?
Yes. As Your Honor knows, third-party consent is a very complicated doctrine, but I believe yes.
So, but you're arguing, here's, and I'm sorry I interrupted you before. You're arguing for a case-by-case analysis, totality of the circumstances when it comes to certain types of apartments, and yet you're arguing for a bright-line rule. And I understand the state's arguing for a bright-line rule, but that doesn't limit the outcome here. You're arguing for a bright-line rule that rooming and boarding houses, all of them, if they qualify under the statute, are off-limits. And yet for totality of the circumstances for apartments that are also covered by many statutes and many regulations. So why the distinction?
This is why, Your Honor. I would love to sit up here. I'd like to say stand, but COVID. I would love to sit here today and argue that all individuals should have constitutional privacy protections in all of their homes. But I have to, as an advocate, acknowledge the case law that exists. And I know that Amici reads some of the case law differently than I do, and reasonable minds might differ. But the way that I read the case law is that some of the case law in New Jersey currently stands for the proposition that individuals do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the common areas of apartment buildings, and some do. So, at least in my estimation, until this court reconciles that, that case law either needs to be overturned or there needs to be some sort of totality of the circumstances test. I'm not really sure. So at a minimum, either the apartment buildings are distinguishable or apartment buildings at a minimum need to be considered on a totality of the basis test, because I feel that I need to at least acknowledge that case law for Your Honors. I feel like I wouldn't be doing my due diligence if I didn't.
What about the standard that the Florida Supreme Court set forth in Titus that Professor Lefebvre says is the better course? If it's a rooming house, get a warrant unless it is obviously open to the public.
I think that that's the best standard. It's the standard that the appellate division promulgated here, and I think that it makes the most sense. As far as boarding and rooming houses, if it's a boarding or rooming house, you get a warrant, because again, boarding and rooming houses are not open to the public. To just take a step back for a second, I know we discussed this a little bit, but New Jersey law requires that all boarding and rooming houses must be lockable, and that every entrance door to leading to living areas must be kept locked at all times except when in actual use. So that, you know, supports our position that boarding and rooming houses are not open to the public. And if an outsider were to actually wander into a boarding or rooming house, you know, let's say that they were to wander through the front door and sit on the couch and turn on, you know, the TV, that outsider would almost certainly be charged with trespass. So again, these are not homes that are open to the public. These are private homes. This is not Target. This is not 7-Eleven. These are private homes where people live. And the idea that, you know, the home is confined to the bedroom is simply misplaced. What ends up happening is that because these bedrooms are so small, as the appellate division described it, this particular bedroom in this case was a Spartan-like bedroom, people end up putting the remainder of their belongings throughout the home. So I might put my plates in the kitchen. I might put my DVDs in the family room. So this idea that you don't have any control over anything throughout the remainder of the home is incorrect.
Let me ask you one more question about the reliance on the statute. And as you were speaking, I was trying to think of another example. You know, obviously there are all kinds of statutes and regulations in New Jersey about all kinds of residences, and in particular residences that are owned by landlords and rented out to residents who may not get the protection they need in terms of security and otherwise. But the fact that a statute says what the standard should be, landlord, you must, in order to operate this residence, you must meet this standard. The fact that the statute sets that bar, why should that be the controlling consideration as opposed to what's actually happening? Do you see what I'm saying? I just find it odd to say a Fourth Amendment standard should be based upon a regulatory or legal standard that landlords are supposed to meet, but it's not a perfect world. And presumably many, many landlords are thumbing their noses to those regulations and statutes. So why shouldn't we look at the reality of what is happening in the individual residence rather than a very laudable regulatory framework and statutory framework that may or may not be complied with? Do you see what I'm saying?
I certainly see what you're saying, Your Honor. I think that it's an inference to be drawn. I think that, in conjunction with the Rooming and Boarding House Act of 1979, which perhaps is much more important, that codifies the tenant's right to privacy and right to not be deprived of any civil, constitutional, or legal rights solely by reason of residence in a boarding or facility or rooming facility. So perhaps that's the more important statute that I should have cited.
I agree with you as to that aspect, but we all know that a statute saying that there must be a lock on a door doesn't necessarily mean there's a lock on the door. That's all. As to the physical requirements imposed by statutes and regulations, I don't see the Fourth Amendment import of those unless they're being complied with, in which case they may be very significant. Do you see what I'm saying?
You could turn that
argument on its head in many, many respects and say there's no requirement. Therefore, if we're relying on statutes and regulations in a Fourth Amendment context, there seems to be something analytically a bit off to me.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. If we look to out-of-state case law, we can look at People v. Douglas, and that court, that was a California case, that court explains that even if individuals can reasonably expect that their roommates might infringe upon their privacy rights, that doesn't necessarily mean that outsiders or the police can, because boarding and rooming houses are not open to the public. So that case, by way of analogy, I know it's not a perfect fit, and obviously it's not statutory, but by way of analogy, I think that that case can be helpful, and it's somewhat analogous to some of our case law, because our case law in New Jersey has always recognized the difference between between someone somewhat infringing upon rights and just a carte blanche infringement. So, for example, in State v. Hempel, this court recognized that when I put my garbage out on the street, I might reasonably expect that, unfortunately, someone might be picking my trash, but it doesn't mean that the police can go through it. So I know it's not a perfect fit, and maybe I'm not answering Your Honor's question perfectly.
I take it that you've presented the 1979 Rooming and Boarding House Act, not to say it's the be and end and all end for our determination whether or not there's a reasonable expectation of privacy under our Constitution or the federal Constitution, but it's evidence that the legislature intended to confer or expect a reasonable expectation of privacy on the residents of boarding and rooming houses. Am I correct about that?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. That we can't know for sure what people are doing, and we can't guarantee that people will be perfect in executing the laws perfectly, but we can surely glean from the legislative intent what the legislature intended for. And so here, from the Rooming and Boarding House Act of 1979, we surely can glean from it that the legislature did not want anyone's constitutional or civil or legal rights to be infringed upon merely by virtue of living in a boarding or rooming house. And so here we know that Article 1, Paragraph 7 shouldn't be infringed upon solely by virtue of living in a boarding or rooming house. And if this case were to be overturned, that's exactly what would occur. And so it really would be the opposite effect of the intent of the Rooming and Boarding House Act of 1979.
Ms. Friedman? We're coming up on the half hour soon. Okay. Is there anything you'd like to stress before you conclude your argument?
I'd just like to also indicate that the fact that the front door's lock was either unlocked or malfunctioning on the date in question is not dispositive. I think that as citizens and as members of the community, we know on an intuitive level that what we do with our front doors and what we do with our locks cannot be dispositive of whether or not we forfeit our constitutional privacy rights, because that's not an objectively reasonable rubric for forfeiture of constitutional privacy rights. And in fact, our case law supports this proposition. In Pennell Bar, the court held that even when a door is wide open, that that's not enough to forfeit one's constitutional privacy rights, that the police still need either a warrant or an exception to the warrants requirement. And then again in Kaltner, the appellate division held and this court affirmed that even throwing an open house party is not enough to forfeit one's objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in the home. And so by way of analogy, the same is true about having one's door unlocked. Someone can have their door unlocked for a myriad of different reasons, whether it's due to just inadvertency, due to the door malfunctioning and they don't know, whether the door is malfunctioning and they've called a locksmith and the locksmith is coming as soon as they can, whether they're unloading their groceries and they're running back and forth. And so it's simply not enough just to have one's door unlocked. And so for each of these reasons, as well as the socioeconomic and equal protection concerns involved, we respectfully ask Your Honors to affirm the Appellate Division's decision.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Shalom.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. The Court, having really dug into the application in this case of the rule proposed by the state, I'm going to try and zoom out and talk more broadly about the rule that the Court should impose. And first, let me start by saying, Chief, that I do believe that the Florida rule would be sufficient in this case, but I don't think it does enough in terms of instruction to law enforcement. So as I zoom out, when we think about why we have rules and what sorts of rules we want under Article 1, Paragraph 7, we're really generally trying to do two things simultaneously. First, we're trying to protect the privacy rights of New Jerseyans. That's paramount. But we also want to provide clear instruction to law enforcement so that they can do their jobs right up to the limit of that privacy right. We don't want to unnecessarily burden them, and we want to be clear. And so, like my colleague who just spoke, Ms. Friedman, I'd like to also talk about State v. Brown. But I don't want to rely on Justice Albin's prose in the majority opinion. Instead, I want to rely on the concerns that really animated the dissent. And so, Justice Patterson and Chief, you both were really concerned that rule, which of course dealt with abandonment, not something we're dealing with here, but was going to require police officers to do lots of research, figure out from utility bills and deeds and public record searches what the exact nature of a particular property was. And I think we want to avoid that here. And there's a simple way to do it, and that is the mailbox test, which is to say, we know, generally speaking, the rule is if you want to enter a home, you need a warrant or an exception, which, of course, the state has forsworn in this case. But let's just say a warrant or an exception. They say, well, but there's this rule that says we can go into common hallways of multi-unit dwellings. I think that they overstate what that rule is. And I think the easiest way to do it is you could do all sorts of totality of circumstances, but the quick thing for a police officer is, can the letter carrier go there? And so imagine an apartment building that has a front door, and then inside that front door, there is a set of mailboxes. The letter carrier can enter that front door and does on a regular basis. We can, from that, infer that so can the pizza delivery person and all sorts of other people, because people get buzzed into those buildings. But then imagine a two-family house or a three-family house that has three mailboxes on the outside of the door, one door, and then you enter and there are some stairs that lead to other locked doors. That interior vestibule and stairwell is not open to the public. It's not open to the letter carrier, and it's not open to the public. So police officers, without knowing whether inside that front threshold is a rooming house, a boarding house, a two-family house, or a single-family house, should know that the warrant requirement forbids them from going in absent a warrant or an exception. That's an easily applied rule that does the work we need. And I think it really, the state says, look, we don't want a different rule from other multifamily dwellings than we do for rooming and boarding houses. And that's true, because they want no privacy protections in either. But that reads too much into our law. Because by the state's logic, any time an area is accessible to any other people, it is devoid of an expectation of privacy. But that's not what our case law has held. It didn't hold that in Kaltner. It didn't hold that in Coles. Justice Lavecchia, you referenced other instances where people have locked single rooms. And so Coles's landlord was his mother. It shouldn't change his aunt, I believe. It shouldn't change the expectation of privacy. And it's also true in Stott. And the state says, well, Stott's different because that was a room. But that was a room where he had a roommate. And the court said, notwithstanding the fact that he had a roommate, he didn't expect, and that the hospital staff could come into the room, he didn't expect the police to. So the state's rule that whenever you expose it to some, you're exposing it to all, to Justice Pierre-Louis' point, is simply belied both by a robust portion of our jurisprudence, but also good logic on what we want police to do, how we want to inform their work. And so while we think it's easy to say, yes, of course, we should have a rule that barring some sign on the door that says open to all or other indicia that the area is open to public, rooming and boarding houses should maintain an expectation of privacy. But beyond that, since we don't want police officers to have to figure out whether it's a rooming and boarding house or a multifamily house or a fraternity house or a dorm room, the rule that is very clear to law enforcement is don't go into a home unless you have a warrant or an exception. But if the mailboxes are in the interior, you can probably go into that area. I think that is a very clear rule and an administrable one.
Mr. Shalom, I'm a little concerned because this puts a lot of stock in how the building itself is constructed. There are multi-unit dwellings where there's a kiosk in the front for mail slots, even though delivery people can walk into the common area. Should we really put all of our stock in where the mailbox is located?
So I think you can do a totality of the circumstances test where if the officer says, I just watched five delivery people go upstairs with pizzas in hand, so I assumed I could do the same, that's fine. But if we also want to give a shorthand to police officers where you have to, there's a burden. And if you want to explain why you thought you had access, why the tenant did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy, the onus is on you unless you can say, well, I just looked at the mailbox and it was easy. I knew that the letter carrier went in, so too could I, certainly.
Mr. Shalom, in this case, the police officer knew it was a rooming house.
Correct.
There may be many other indicia of that something is a rooming house other than a mailbox. I mean, so planting everything on whether or not there is a mailbox as opposed to a slot seems to be too facile a rule.
Just to be clear, the kind of benefit of that rule is that it applies to all sorts of multi-unit dwellings, because the state's position is if you're in a multi-unit dwelling that is not a rooming and boarding house, you also have no expectation of privacy.
So here's another thing. We have one issue before us, whether or not there's a reasonable expectation for a rooming house or a boarding house. We don't have apartment house complex before us. And I don't see any reason why we should be taking on an issue that is not squarely before us and hasn't been appropriately argued on that basis. What do you have to say about that?
That is an absolutely fair point and something very reasonable for the court to do, to take that kind of position of judicial restraint and only answer the question directly before it. However, in so doing, I caution the court to not overstate the claim, which is to say not contrast boarding and rooming houses against other multifamily dwellings, because I don't think the state's argument relying on, you know, a case from 1952 that says, by the way, you have no expectation of privacy here, is sufficient to do it. So agreed, you can just squarely answer the question before you.
And what about the argument?
One thing I just wanted to say, you are, when you use that mailbox rule, you're using it as there may be indicia, there may be times when a rooming house or boarding house is open to the public. And one of the indicia, which doesn't exist here, is the mailbox inside the door.
I think that overstates what I'm saying, Justice Solomon. I think I'm saying that in some apartment buildings, the mailbox may indicate you can go in to a first threshold. I think it would be a stretch to say that because the mailbox is there, you have no expectation of privacy, for example.
No, I'm saying that would be one of the indicators.
Yes,
that could be and there may be others. So I thought that's all you were saying. That would be some addition. Okay. Just clarify.
I was interpreting your question, your position, Mr. Shalom, almost as a threshold. What is the threshold? Because a lot has been made of analogizing rooming and boarding houses to multi-dwelling apartment-type structures. But I was coming at this more, at least initially, analogizing it to the threshold of a single-family home. I mean, if this is all shared premises, but nevertheless all part of the home of the individual, even though parts are clearly padlocked and others are not, then it's the threshold that can't be crossed by police, whether the front door is locked or not, just like you wouldn't for a single-family home. And your mailbox rule harkened me back to a similar consideration for apartment buildings. What's the threshold of the apartment building? I don't want to try to think that we, in this case, need to answer every apartment building question that could come up, but the hypotheticals that you were giving us suggest that there might be different thresholds for an interior door beyond, locked door beyond the mailboxes. In some upper class, very wealthy apartment buildings, there's a doorman who doesn't allow individuals in. It's not mailboxes, it's somebody who actually stands guard and asks, who are you there to see, and calls up to determine whether or not admittance is permissible. So I'm not sure how far to go with your suggestion that totality of the circumstances helps police here. I am wondering if we should return back to a discussion of whether or not a rule can be fashioned that includes all rooming and boarding houses at the front door, period.
Justice Levesque, as I said, I'm totally comfortable with that. I want to be clear. I agree with your analysis that when the officer pounded on the door and opened it, and then saw inside some other rooms that were locked. I live in a single family home, and if the officer pounded on my door and it opened it, inside he saw a safe. He couldn't say, oh, well, he's got that safe, which indicates a privacy right within it, and therefore I can come and look at anything that's surrounding the safe. But you can have multiple layers of privacy, and it doesn't mean... And that threshold is that which he should not have crossed in this case. And I think if the court wants to confine its argument, its opinion, I'm sorry, to the question of can they cross the threshold in a rooming and boarding house, because as Justice Albin says, here the record is clear that the officer knew it was a rooming and boarding house, I think that's fine. What I fear we're going to see going forward, if the rule is limited to that, is a lot of officers who said, oh, I thought it was a multi-unit dwelling. I hadn't realized it was a rooming and boarding house under the statute, and therefore I went. And so I think there is some clarity that says the presumption is you don't go into homes absent a warrant or an mm-hmm. exception to the warrant requirement. And again, we're right. at like first principles of Article 1, Paragraph 7.
Well, I think we should equate as in importance not only the expectation of privacy for the individuals, but the need for clarity for police so that they know exactly what they need to do and what they can do up to, as you said earlier, up to the exact line beyond which they can go no further without a warrant.
Unless the court has any questions, I ask for you to affirm the appellate division. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Mr. Harbist.
May it please the court, your honors. I will start with the core judicial principle in Florida versus Jardines. There, the Supreme Court pronounced that when it comes to the Fourth Amendment, the home is the first among equals. In that case, the Supreme Court stated that there was a right of a man to retreat into his own home. That right to privacy, your honors, was echoed by this court just a few years ago in State versus Wright, where the court noted that one of our most protected rights has been the sanctity and privacy of a person's home. Mr. Williams was not afforded that right. Why? The state says because the front door of the boarding home where he lived was unlocked and could be pushed open. But I submit to the court that there's no open door exception to the Fourth Amendment. That issue has been covered, and I won't go into the rationale for that. Justice Albin pointed out the boarding home regulations require that the doors be locked to the living area here. The door was equipped with a lock as well as a closed storm door. There is no requirement that individuals take all possible precautions to prevent unwanted entry. Here, we submit there was an expectation of privacy in the common areas. As Justice Albin noted, that has been legislated by the Rooming and Boarding Act that prescribes a right to privacy and a right to constitutional protections. There, we submit, is a subjective expectation of privacy in rooming or boarding homes to the common areas. They are not open to the public. On this record, the house was not an apartment building or multi-unit structure. Here, the record is clear that the detective described, and I'll point to the court's opinion below, the dwelling as an attached row home that could be a normal single-family home or a multi-family home. So it appeared to be a home when the detectives approached. When he entered the property through the front door, it caused him to believe that the property was a boarding house, and that is what the record states. Here, an individual should be able to retreat into the sanctity of his private enclave. The amicus here is advocating a straightforward rule. Before the police enter what looks like to be a home, they need a warrant. Here, the testimony was that the building looked like a home. Therefore, the officer should have obtained a warrant. Perhaps they could have knocked on the door, rang the bell to continue their investigation. But if they wanted to enter, the Fourth Amendment requires that they needed a warrant. Indeed, the record shows that they entered twice in this case, even after concluding on their first entry that it was a boarding home. We submit that the court should find that the police in this case should have adhered to the time-honored constitutional principle. Just to address Justice Patterson's question of whether there is a principal distinction between a multi-unit dwelling and a boarding home, and she brought up the example of a laundry room that is on many occasions in a multi-unit dwelling. There are basic functions that we all have. The right to sleep in a bed, the right to prepare our meals in a kitchen, to use a bathroom. Perhaps a laundry room is a distinction. That isn't a basic function. Some of us are wealthy enough to take our laundry to a cleaner's. Some of us have to do them in the bathtub. But we are not advocating a totality of the circumstances approach in this case. The approach should be that if a home looks like a home, if it looks like a duck and talks like a duck, it is a duck, and that should be the presumption that the police function under to preserve the Fourth Amendment.
Any questions, anyone? Mr. Harbist, anything else?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dominguez, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, just three brief points. The state, too, is concerned with providing clarity to law enforcement when they're conducting their investigations. And we're not asking, of course, this court to find that there's no privacy expectations in the interior boarding houses or any other multi-unit dwellings, just that it doesn't extend beyond the individual rooms of the tenants in the boarding houses. I would also just briefly note that Kaltner, the fraternity case, and Stott talked about, involved the officers entering into the individual rooms, the individual hospital room, the individual fraternity room. Here, the officer did not enter the room until he had obtained a search warrant. He merely accessed the common areas after determining that this was a boarding house, that this was a multi-unit dwelling. I would also just note for the record that there's no indication in the record to suggest that the officers were barging into or pounding on the door. All we know is that the officers knocked on the front door because it was unsecured and unlocked. It opened. And I would also just note that the public defender has mentioned a number of out-of-state cases, which have found that there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in the common areas. But I would also note that this is really a split question when we look at out-of-state cases. And the state has cited a number of cases that have held otherwise, that have found that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in the common areas of a boarding house for the same reasons that there aren't in other multi-unit dwellings. And unless the court has any other questions, we would ask that this court reverse the judgment of the appellate division.
Thank you, Mr. Dominguez. Thank you to all counsel.